Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all here. We started off with Eddie Floyd because today is his birthday. Born in 1935. That song came out in 1966. It was one of the great hits of the moment, at least for me. I always liked that song. I still like that song. This is also the birthday, 1903, died in 1950, of George Orwell. And one of my favorite quotes I'll share with you here from George Orwell, he has many, but one thing that stuck with me all the time, he who controls the past controls the future. He who controls the present controls the past. And it's a real watchword for us as we think about where life is going. It's also the birthday of Jimmy Walker, who created dynamite in our world, and now is a spokesman for the right wing. And Sonia Sotomayor was born on this day as well. But this day in history also was this, and we'll be playing during our breaks for the rest of the show, the music of Michael Jackson, who died on this day in 2009. And so we'll remember him and do a show about him a little bit later, but we're going to at least put his music on today. This day in 1773 was a huge day legally in America when slaves in Massachusetts petitioned for their freedom. It was upheld, and the measure became law because of their legal battle to end slavery in Massachusetts and their enslavement. This was also the day in 1868 when Congress, then progressive after the Civil War, forced states to give African Americans rights, North Carolina, South Carolina, Louisiana, Georgia, Alabama, and Florida. And the condition that their constitutions of said states shall never be amended or changed as to deprive any citizen or class of citizens or the United States the right to vote in said states who are entitled to vote by the Constitution. And we're all waiting, and have a program about this waiting in the wings. As soon as the decision comes down from the Supreme Court about voting rights, we'll be covering that with some intensity next Tuesday at 9 a.m. Sherilyn Ifill, who's now the president of the NAACP's defense fund, will be joining us at 9 o'clock to talk about that as well. This was also the anniversary of the Battle of Little Bighorn, which we talked about and more. And that is where we'll leave the day in history today. Oh, well, this couple little quick things are important for some of our folks. 1975, this is the day that Mozambique achieved independence. This is also a day in 1943 when Jews in Poland didn't go quietly into the night and stood up and fought the Nazis hand to hand. So our day in history. And we are going to talk about the present day in our world. Greg Bernstein's in the studio, Baltimore City State's attorney, along with Sonia Kumar, staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland. The last she joined us was to talk about the ACLU report on marijuana. And Greg Bernstein, on June 20th last week, wrote this really interesting editorial, as I wrote to him a note, saying a very thoughtful editorial, well thought out, about marijuana legalization, but more about decriminalization and what that means as we consider the report, the ACLU. I would say that Greg Bernstein, of all our elected officials, whether you agree with what he wrote or not, was the first one really to stand up and respond to it. We've been asking for our elected officials across the state to respond to the ACLU report, because it deserves response given the numbers of African Americans being locked up for marijuana possession and more. And Greg did respond to it. And Greg, good to have you both in the studio.
Thank you.
So that's very quickly, if you talk about, you didn't address the issue of legalization, which we'll come to in a little bit, but very much in the editorial, but you did address the issue of decriminalization and your questions about how we should approach this slowly, as you were saying. Talk a bit about your thesis for those who haven't read it, then we'll let Sonia respond to it.
Well, I think the message that I am trying to get across is that I think that the ACLU study raises very important and difficult questions, which I think need to be considered and addressed. And I think that it may very well cause a reaction from our legislators to perhaps do something with respect to the current laws regarding marijuana. That's a legitimate debate that people should have. I'm happy to be a part of that debate. But I just caution everyone to move deliberately because, as I said in the op-ed piece, that what may be a seemingly simple decision to either decriminalize or legalize marijuana may result in a lot of unintended consequences that we need to be very thoughtful about in how we address. I mean, my focus, Mark, you've heard me say this time after time after time, that as state's attorney, my focus is on the prosecution of repeat violent offenders who are plaguing our city with violent acts, shootings and the like. And as state's attorney, that's my job, is to prosecute those violent offenders as a matter of public safety, as a matter of recidivism, and preventing those folks from terrorizing our cities and neighborhoods. But that's one end of the spectrum, and I spend most of my waking hours focusing on that.
Which we'll talk about later in the program as well, because that's because of what happened. Go ahead.
But on the other, on the other, on the other end, of course, you've got, and the ACLU study, of course, points this out. You have a number of people who are being arrested for marijuana possession. You have a number of people who are being arrested for nonviolent offenses, and so we need to think of ways other than to simply incarcerate those individuals to address those issues. And what I can do as state's attorney is deal with those cases once the arrest is made in a way that maybe is a little more thoughtful, maybe is a way that prevents people that are being arrested for possession of marijuana and other small nonviolent offenses from getting a criminal conviction, from being incarcerated. These kinds of effects have enormous consequences on people if you have a conviction. It prevents you from employment opportunities. It prevents you from work opportunities. And so if we can channel these folks into diversion-type programs and in ways in which they don't get convictions, we can be, I think, much more effective. We can, and in fact, that's what we're doing. As we have doubled our participation in our marijuana diversion program in the last year, where we take individuals who are arrested for possession of small amounts of marijuana by getting them to agree or asking them to agree to perform a small amount of community service and get some lecture, you know, on marijuana use and other drug use. In exchange for that, we dismiss the case. And we've even expanded it. We've had folks who have gone through the program and then get arrested again for marijuana possession, and we let them do it again. We also have a program for people who are arrested for non-marijuana drug possession, like heroin, cocaine, things of that nature. That's a little more intensive, of course, for obvious reasons, but it's the same concept. If you do not have violence in your history, you do not commit a violent offense, and you have a clean record, a relatively clean record, this is a way to try to maintain it. Now, what does that do? That does a lot of things. It, first of all, keeps those folks out of jail, keeps them out of central booking, you know, and the resources that are affected by that. Because, you know, you get a lot of people who, you know, have a job where they're working day to day. If they miss 2-3 days of work, they get fired.
Right.
And so we need to figure out ways for those folks who are getting arrested for these kind of nonviolent offenses to keep them out of jail. So that's one effect. The other effect is it reduces our already clogged court system, allows us to focus our resources on what I believe are the more serious violent felonies, which is where we've got to devote a lot of our resources. So those are the things that I can do as state's attorney and what we are doing.
So did you have issue with the editorial at all, Sonia?
Well, first of all, I actually want to thank Mr. Bernstein, because I think he makes a lot of really important points, and I appreciate sort of the significance of acknowledging the consequences of what happens after somebody is arrested. But I want to sort of reframe a little bit, because I think that one of the the central point of the ACLU's report is the race disparities in marijuana enforcement. And I think it fundamentally, Mr. Bernstein's right, it's a report about policing, and it's about what we're doing about that. But I also think that he is right to acknowledge that policing is not just in the hands of the city commissioner, right? It's in the hands of all of us that are part of a system that incentivizes what police are doing. But just to go back to the numbers a little bit, because I think that the numbers for us were part of what drove us to frame to view this as really important. And between 2001 and 2010, arrests for marijuana possession in Baltimore City increased by 80%, from less than 4,000 arrests to more than 7,000 arrests. And there was a 3,000 increase of 3,000 arrests. Almost all of those increases were of African Americans, right? So 92% of the arrests were African Americans. So in Baltimore City, if we put it in sort of the numbers, it's one out of 62 African Americans versus one out of 347. So it's whites when are arrested. So it's nearly six times the rate. But I think the point that we're trying to make is that we need to stop treating the racial disparities as a sort of unfortunate byproduct of an otherwise sound system and start analyzing and understanding and conceptualizing the race disparities as a central problem and figuring out, as Mr. Bernstein says, what we do in response to that. And so, you know, I totally appreciate you know, the commitment Mr. Bernstein's made to diversion for low-level offenders, including marijuana possession. But out of, you know, 1,400 people were participated in the diversion program, I think was the number on the op-ed, and there were 7,000 arrests. So what about that other chunk of people? And, of course, what about the consequences of arrest itself? Because he's right that the criminal convictions and the court time, all of those things matter, but also the arrests matter, right? And that's something that we've heard over and over again from talking to people, that the harms actually arise from arrest, not just the prosecution and conviction.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. We'll come to your calls coming in. And, well, great. The two things. I mean, I'm curious to follow up what Sonia was saying. I mean, A, at the highest levels, do you and the commission or the mayor and other folks actually discuss why it is that more African Americans are being arrested than white Americans in Baltimore for smoking marijuana, when we know equal amounts of each smoke marijuana in the city of Baltimore per capita, especially young people, and why that is and what you do to ameliorate and stop that? And two, just about the 7,000 arrests and those numbers, that's a huge number of people.
Right. Well, I would note that between 2011 and 2012, so in just the last year, the number of marijuana arrests has dropped 1,000. So it's gone from 7,200 in 2011. It's down to 6,000 this past year. So it's trending down, which is not to say that it is still a high number. I don't want to, you know, mislead your listeners in any way. But I think it is significant to note that in the last year it's dropped 1,000. It's also interesting to note what the percentage is, because as a percentage, the marijuana arrests represent roughly 11% of total arrests, and I, you know, that's a significant number, and I, which is exactly what the point that Sonia is trying to make. I think that when we start talking about arrest and consequences, to follow up on Sonia's point, it's a good one, because the diversion program that I talked about that we have is a good one, right? But you need to think about, well, what can we do? What's the next step? And so, for example, the legislature has been actually fairly proactive about that. They've recently, in the last session, passed a citation bill, which you may be familiar with, which permits the police to, assuming certain criteria are met, to issue citations either on site or after bringing the suspect to the police station, that simply directs them to appear in court. So what that accomplishes, is it addresses the point that Sonia was making, I was making earlier, that we want to try to think of ways to avoid not only the stigma of the conviction, but the impact of the arrest and being locked up, things of that nature. So by giving them the citation and just directing them to appear in court, that's, of course, another step in the direction that the report was addressing.
Well, I'm going to open the phones here. Folks calling in to join us at 410-319-8888. But I do want to come back. The question still remains to me. We don't address the underlying reason why, A, we're arresting more African Americans than anybody else, even in counties that are mostly white. We're arresting more African-Americans, why that is, and do people at the top wrestle with this issue to figure out why to stop it and address it? And B, and I think you're right in your article when you talked about decriminalization won't stop the violence. I think you're absolutely right. Only legalization will stop the violence. We can maybe come back to that. 410-319-8888, at least that's my supposition. Ricky, you're on the air. Hi, Ricky, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, sir. How are you?
Very
Thanks
well.
Thanks for having me. Mr. Bernstein, I had a question I'd like to ask you, but first let me preface that by saying I think that you have, since you've been in office, exhibited an extensive and and a pretty fair amount of knowledge about what goes on here in the city and state in regard to legal issues relevant to your position. The question is this. About 2-3 years ago, I submitted a proposal to Mr. Anthony Guglielmi, a former city police department spokesman, concerning how best the Baltimore City Police Department could work in cooperation with city residents toward alleviating and participating in the criminal justice process. My suggestion was that instead of looking for singular witnesses who could be retaliated and targeted, they need to tie in with the community associations in every quadrant of the city, whereby these organizations with mass numbers could point the finger at crime and criminals in unity as opposed to singularly, whereas though the heart is much easier to cut the head off one chicken than it is 100, 500, or 1,000. I just wanted to know, what did you think of that?
Well, Ricky, that's a great question because it, I think in a way, I think responds to one of the comments that Steiner was just making, you know, earlier, and I'll show you how it connects in a minute. But because what I think, Ricky, your question goes to is the notion that at its initial starting point, the police department needs to address these kinds of issues that we're talking about. I know that this is something that Commissioner Batts is very sensitive to. I know that he's, for example, doing everything he can to improve training and professionalism within the police department. I know that he has designated one of his former majors, given him now a lieutenant colonel position, to kind of be the liaison to all the community groups to try to continue to build the relationships between the police department and the community. And so I think that that's their role, and I think that they're addressing it. And I would expect that they would read carefully the ACLU study and the comments, of course, that Sonia's making today, and work in that regard. And, Ricky, so I think that your question is a good one in that respect, because that's really kind of where it begins. I think that more particularly on the issue of, you know, developing witnesses – And ensuring that they're not retaliated against. You know, witness retaliation is an issue that I spend a lot of time on. It's a fundamental problem in our system. It makes our jobs very difficult to obtain convictions in cases. We work on it constantly by, you know, working on our victim witness programs and being out in the community, trying to engage the community. I know the police department does that as well. So I think Ricky makes a good point.
410-319-8888. Doug, you're on the air. Doug, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hello?
Hi, Doug, you're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Oh, Doug Holbert, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, good morning. Good morning, Mr. Bernstein. How are you today?
I'm well, Doug.
Good.
How are you?
Good. I'm fine, thank you. So, it's a very important discussion, and I'm really glad that that we're having it this morning. Our law students have been representing people arrested for marijuana possession and only possession for many years. And one of the critical issues that happens when people are arrested is that many receive a bail, and the bail could be as low as $100 or $200, and many of our clients, we find them in jail 2 weeks later and even 3 weeks later because the family cannot afford the $200 bail. And so one thing that I think can be done, and this would not be, I don't think this would be a difficult thing to do, would be for your office, Mr. Bernstein, to take a look at the marijuana arrests when they first come into the system and to recommend that people be released on their own recognizance without having to put up bail money, except in the unusual case where there's something in the person's background that makes them a danger to others or a serious flight risk. But for most people, I mean, we just represented two 19-year-old who had no prior convictions. They had missed court on at least one occasion. When they came in, they had one had a $300 bail, the other had a $200 bail, and they literally could not afford the money. The parent, the grandparents, simply did not have the money to put up. And I think if you would recommend, take a look at these cases in the first 24 hours and recommend release on recognizance, then people would not be punished before they've even been found guilty. And I think that's a one way of dealing with this very serious problem.
Well, thanks, Doug. For the listeners' benefit, Professor Colbert, who is Doug Colbert, is professor at the University of Maryland, and he has raised this issue with me on a number of occasions since I became state's attorney. These are very kind of thought-provoking issues, and I've tried to take them seriously and to address them appropriately. I mean, I would say that it's important to note that there are anywhere between 50 to 55,000 people that are arrested every year in Baltimore City. We have at Central Booking, where everyone who is arrested is taken, state's attorneys who are there 24/7 who review charging papers. But we don't review all of them, so we're not able to address every case that, comes in. And certainly the system that's set up currently where people appear before a court commissioner who makes those kinds of determinations is an issue that should be addressed because they're really the ones that determine, you know, what the release conditions should be. I think the better thing, though, the better way to approach this issue, is to think about, and this is what Sonia and I were just getting in a dialogue about before the show, and she was alluding to when she was commenting earlier, is we need to think about ways to avoid the step where they're even brought to Central Booking, where they're and where the bail is set. So, for example, in Seattle, there's a program that they're running that is pretty successful called the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program. Sonia and I were talking about this before. She's familiar with it. The acronym is LEAD. And it's a great program. The idea is that – now, this requires a big commitment from city government and the police department. This is really a law enforcement function. It's not so much from my state's attorney's office, but it's a way to keep these folks out of the system because what this program is designed to do is the police officers are trained that if they are confronted with suspects who meet certain criteria, who are in possession, say, of small amounts of marijuana or some other small negligible case, rather than arresting them, rather than giving them a citation, they direct them right to services where they are interviewed by someone in intake and they move them into certain services so that in that way you cut out the whole system and you get them the services that they need and hopefully they don't reoffend.
I want to talk about what could be some policies. I mean, have you thought out about your report and you have talked to ACLU? You said, I mean, it's clear, but no aspersions here, Greg, that people at the top.
I mean, I'm sorry, were you looking at Sonia or me?
Both of you, actually.
Oh, I wasn't curious. I wanted to make sure who you were asking the question.
I was talking to Sonia, when I asked the question.
Sonia doesn't get to say much here.
Because these callers came in, they were talking to you, so I wanted to. That's why I wanted Sonia on the beginning to talk about this marijuana thing, which we may bleed over into the second half for a minute so we can finish this part of our conversation. But what comes out of this for you in terms of the conversation about what could be the alternative?
You've
heard what the state's attorney said.
Right, and I appreciate a lot of it, and I think, you know, he's got to deal with what the law is right now. And in my view, even if every single person that is arrested were diverted, we would still have a policing problem, right? Because there's – I mean, if all of the people who are being stopped for marijuana are still – African-American and not white, we're not solving that problem. So I think that absolutely, you know, from the ACLU's perspective, there are a set of issues here that require sort of a range of responses. And one of them as everybody I think is plainly discussing is sort of the notion of how we regulate marijuana. And so that's really critical. But I think that there's another really critical question, which is how we do our policing and how we incentivize police to enforce the law. And I think, you know, one of the things that sort of that comes up is police will I think sometimes say we're not trying to enforce marijuana laws. It's basically just so useful to us as a tool for searching people. And so one of the things that I think that we need to be doing is making sure that police are, and that's not really fair to the sort of the members of the African-American community that are then.
Let me let you hold that thought. We're going to come back and let you finish the thought. We come back and go to the phones after at 410-319-8888, finish the marijuana conversation, and move into the question of 8 people being killed over the weekend, 20 injured, and what is our response to that? We'll be right back. Died 4 years ago today. We're playing his music at every break. Greg Bernstein's in the studio, Baltimore City State's attorney. Sonia Kumar's in the studio, staff attorney for the ACLU of Maryland, that wrote the report on the disproportionate number of African Americans arrested for marijuana. 410-319-8888. Sonia, we're in the middle of a thought. We have to go to break.
Yeah, and I think that this is sort of one of the main points for the ACLU is that, you know, this is in many ways about citizen encounters, police, how police interact with Baltimore residents, and stop and frisk, and for every arrest, there are countless others who are stopped and searched, and who are let go by police. But without information about sort of what's happening in those contexts, I mean, that's really how we're going to get at, I think, the race disparities in marijuana enforcement. Accountability in how police engage with citizens in every interaction. And that means tracking what happens in those citizen encounters in terms of documenting every single one, and also reviewing what happens. What are the hit rates like? Are their searches good? Are they finding contraband? Are they finding guns when they do the search? Because it's also just, I think, a matter of, you know, the more you think of it, the more it feels so obvious. Like, if police are just, you know, hitting as many people as they can, that seems far less efficient and productive than being really intentional about who's being searched. And I think that the data in terms of in places where that information is available has really bore that out. In New York, I forget what the exact number is, but the number of instances in which they're actually recovering guns or other types of contraband is really small.
It's very low. Small. I have the numbers here, but I'll pull them up in a second. They're very low.
It's really low, and I think that and think of the police, you know, person hours that are spent that are lost on these sort of pointless stops that actually totally corrode the relationship between police and the people in the community.
So, I mean, could we? What would stop us? Nothing, I think, when you think about it. When I talk to other people around the country, legally wise, in terms of what would stop us from just saying we're not going to arrest people for just possession of marijuana? We're just not going to do it. Which is not going to arrest them. We're just going to stop doing that. While we wrestle with why too many African-Americans are being arrested in the state, while we wrestle with the whole question of legalization or decriminalization, why don't we just stop arresting people for small amounts of marijuana in their possession, period?
Well, respectfully, I mean, you and I know each other well, but respectfully, I would strongly, strongly disagree with that statement or that
why?
And here's why. Because I think it goes directly to the point that I was making in the op-ed piece I wrote about the unintended consequences. Because the fact of the matter is a lot of the violence in the city is being fueled by the marijuana trade. It's being fueled by rival groups competing over turf to sell marijuana. disputes about the sale of marijuana. If you just simply say we're no longer going to arrest people for possession of marijuana, you run the risk that the market will explode. I mean, you saw the numbers I put in the article about the money that can be made. That's why, Mark, I just think it's crucial that if you're going to have this kind of a debate, which is a different, very different debate from what Sonia's talking about. And this is the point that Sonia's been trying to make all morning. And, you know, the ACLU study is addressing this from a completely different angle in terms of the racial disparities in terms of the arrests. But what you and I are talking about right now is simply the issue of either decriminalization or legalization. And if you just simply decriminalize, just say we're no longer going to arrest people without thinking about all these other consequences, I think you're making a grave, grave mistake. That's why I think the really prudent thing to be doing, again, putting aside Sonia's point, the really prudent thing to be doing would be to study what's happening in the state of Washington and Colorado, where they have just legalized possession of small amounts of marijuana. See how that plays out. Look at the regulations they're developing. They're taking a much more broader approach, and that's, I think, the way to do it, if you're going to do anything.
Some people argue the only way you address this whole question of marijuana arrest, period, is just legalization of marijuana. Legalizing it, taxing it, following it, and just be done with it, because you are not going to take the violence out of drug trade by decriminalizing it. You're right. I think you're correct in your article about that. But I think the next step is, what do you do in its place? Because we have a system now where middle-class white kids buy their marijuana in a different way than poor working-class black kids, and the way our system already kind of views young black men as a danger, that they're the ones who get arrested and put in jail for small amounts of marijuana and never get out. Well, white kids never get arrested for 98% of all arrests in Baltimore City for marijuana for teenagers.
Yeah, we're African-American.
We're African-American. And that is just absurd. I mean, it's just the numbers don't make any sense.
Right.
That's what has to be addressed. And I would ask. I just lost my seat of belt. And
get off your high horse.
Get off my high horse. I just got off my high horse.
But very good.
No, he's supposed to say
I
that.
I know,
not me.
No.
But let me go back to the phones here. 410-319-8888. Jordan, you're on the air. We have a lot of calls coming in. You can hang out for a while.
More than welcome.
Jordan, you're on the air. Jordan, you're on the air.
Hello? Yeah.
Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well.
Yeah. I had a question for the state's attorney.
Sure.
You know, I had a question about the quality of the police work when you compare Commissioner Bailfield to Commissioner Bass. I want to know, was the police work better under Bailfield or was it better under Bass? And how has that affected, State's Attorney Bernstein's ability to get quality convictions? I think he's been doing a fantastic job with the tools and the resources that have been put in front of him, and certainly the circumstances. But I just think that if the police work was a little bit better, when you look at like the Felicia Barnes case and the Tavon White case and stuff like that, if he had some better evidence and some better police work, would he be able to raise the conviction rate?
Well, Jordan, when I ran for state's attorney, and it's only been, I've only been state's attorney now for 2.5 years, but one of the key components that drove me to run and that I talked about was building better relationships with the police department, because I think you're spot on in your question. That is how we are successful in obtaining convictions against these repeat violent offenders that I was talking about before, which, of course, was where our focus needs to be. And we have been single-minded in that approach. We work with the police department on a regular basis now. It takes time, of course, but we meet regularly. We have regular meetings, for example, with the detectives in the homicide division. We meet monthly at the different police districts to discuss potential VRO targets. These are all things that were not done before. We've set up some training opportunities for the detectives where my assistant state's attorneys go in and help them in terms of affidavit writing and things of that nature. So I think, Jordan, it's way too early to make any kind of comparisons. I mean, what I would say is that your question is spot on, and it's one that I'm focused on in terms of building that kind of relationship, because as you quite aptly point out, the more we can build collaborative relationships with the police department, the more we can work together to build these cases, the more successful we're going to be.
410-319-8888. Regina, you're on the air.
Carbon
Regina, turn on your radio, please. You're on the air.
Okay.
Welcome. So you have to turn off your radio or turn it down. Thank you.
Okay.
Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi, I'm Regina, and I'm calling from Baltimore City, and I work in education, and I disagree with the premise that people who are in possession of small amounts of marijuana and, you know, decriminalizing that would contribute to the turf wars that are occurring. I think it's reasonable. Those are two different groups of people, people who are involved in the drug distribution of people who possess small amounts of marijuana. For example, a lot of kids, and I'm not making a moral judgment one way or the other, a lot of kids who may be in possession of small amounts of marijuana, once they're involved in the criminal system, that can potentially destroy their lives when they need other services. So I agree in like the model that other states are using of providing social services to those people who might be in possession of small amounts of marijuana. But I don't agree that everyone or even large groups of people who are in possession of small amounts of marijuana are contributing to the violence in the city, which I see on a daily basis. And I think it's reasonable to presume that if there's a person who's involved in the drug distribution trade or who's involved in turf war would also have other charges that would come up when they are arrested or when they are booked or whatever the process may be, or may be in possession of weapons, whereas people who are just strictly in possession of it are typically, and this of course is a generalization, are not a part of that turf war or do not have weapons or those kinds of things. So I just want to make that distinction between the different groups of people who we're talking about.
Right, and Regina, you make a very important distinction, and it's one that should be made. The point that I was trying to make in the op-ed piece about the turf wars and the violence was simply that if you only decriminalize, or as Mark was saying earlier, if you just, you know, kind of say we're going to have a busman's holiday here and we're just not going to arrest people for possession of small amounts of marijuana, my concern is what that's doing is it's creating a market. It's driving the market. It's making the market larger. It's making it more attractive for the more violent people that you allude to engage in the drug trade, which in turn I think we need to be very careful about, because in fact what's already happening and we're seeing in our city is turf battles that are going on between rival drug groups to control territory where they can sell marijuana. So I think you are absolutely right that you do not want to lump these two groups together, and certainly juveniles or young people that get caught with small amounts of marijuana certainly are not part of some overriding, you know, drug gang. I mean, and that's the point of the ACLU study. That's some of the issues I was raising in my article.
And I think, just to add to that, I think, but that sort of speaks to why certainly the ACLU, and I think many people who have been thinking about this, favor legalization over just decriminalization, because of the rationale being that legalization sort of disincentivizes and devalues the market for drug distribution.
Yeah, in other words, the issues address the larger issues of the kind of systemic racism that arrests more black people than arrests white people, or B, addresses the issue. I think you're right. The only way to deal with it, you can't deal with it with decriminalization. It's only legalization, or you continue arresting. I don't think there's that's the polls we're stuck with.
Right, and I want to just be clear that when we say legalization, we mean regulating and taxing. Right, we're not just talking about the notion that sort of marijuana is sort of widely used by everyone. We're still talking about meaningful controls on when it's used, on public intoxication, all of the same things that apply, for example,
to
alcohol, and sort of that same model of sort of. So it's not about sort of. I think that's really important.
Right, and to that point. Sonia, that is a great segue by Sonia, because that's another thing that we were raising in the article, that you can't just pass a law if the legislature decides they're just going to pass a law legalizing marijuana. Well, you know, the devil is in the details.
Right.
I mean, that's really the bottom line here. The devil is in the details. You've got to figure out the age. You've got to do the training. You got it for the police. You've got to figure out what constitutes intoxication or being under the influence of the drug. Who's going to grow it? How are you going to sell it? I mean, there's just a whole range of issues that are going to need to be very thoughtfully considered before anybody decides that this is the way.
I agree. Although I think they're probably much easier to get to than I don't think it's that long to a process to figure out how do you legalize marijuana and regulate it.
Well, I don't know. If you've been following what's going on in Washington, Colorado, it's not that simple.
It's difficult, but it can be done, I think. Rather have that struggle than having kids being put in jail. But let me ask another question before we go back to the phones here. And Tyrone, you're our next caller up, and Clarence. Over the weekend, we had the spike in shootings and killings. 8 people killed and 20 people wounded. This is not your department, but in terms of this comment, but Anthony Guglielmi, who I have a great deal of respect for and who I like and we've worked with a lot over the years through both these administrations, when he says this has been a little bit of a spike in terms of the weekend, but all in all, we're pretty satisfied with the way the city is headed violence-wise, and then is also quoted by the Sun as saying these incidents are going to happen, so we want to set realistic expectations. What's important is how we respond. To me, responses like that are troublesome because they can't go to an overarching sense of what's the value of human life here we're talking about, A. And B, are we really figuring out how to address the violence in our community? Because 8 people were killed over the weekend. 8 people. 20 shot. I mean, that is a lot of people. It's not just – I don't care if the numbers have gone down or not. I mean, when you have 20 people shot in a weekend, that to me is almost – epidemic proportions in a community of our size, especially when they are centered in certain sectors of our community, populations is even more. Do you know what I'm saying, Greg? I mean, we have to. How do we begin to address this? Is it more aggressive policing? Do we have to think about safe streets being and rec centers being part of this budget process to kind of address this violence beyond just the policing? Because this is a very serious issue. 8 people lost their lives.
It is a very serious issue. It is, for me as state's attorney, the most important issue. It is the one that I've been single-mindedly focused on since I became state's attorney. Any gun violence in our city is unacceptable, and we need to be working 24/7 to prevent it at all times. And that's what I'm doing in the state's attorney's office. That's why I created the Major Investigations Unit as soon as I came in, whose focus is on the repeat violent offenders. It's had a tremendous amount of success in the couple of years it's been in operation. We've successfully convicted and incarcerated a number of these repeat violent offenders. We address the violence that's occurring in the streets on a regular basis. Just yesterday, my chief deputy state's attorney, my number two guy, and the head of my major investigations unit was meeting with the command staff of the Baltimore Police Department in order to discuss ways in which we can stop this violence from continuing. We talk about strategies. Investigative strategies. We talk about developing intelligence. We talk about using our resources. This is a very serious problem, and it's the one that I am focused on all the time.
Let me open the phone to you again at 410-319-8888, and let us go to Eric. You're on the air. Eric, you're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Steiner. Good morning to the panel.
Good morning.
Real quick. Whenever in this country that there is a discussion about the behavior, particularly of especially black men, but in the black community and the problems and the issues that we have and solutions, it's unfair that many in the media don't offer all of the solutions that have been implemented. And, Mr. Stein, I listen to your show all the time, and nobody ever mentioned Minister Farrakhan, Elijah Muhammad, and the Nation of Islam. They have been the most successful, in my opinion, and I would challenge anybody to show me any other organization that has been that successful with changing our lives and our thinking to be better people. And I'm not talking about just being focused on religious ideology, but the message that has been used all over the country. People, police officers, mayors, contact him. Find out what happened and what he did to be that successful. And it's not fair in the media that we don't put all of the information out. If people want to decide, okay, we don't agree with it, fine. But the media should put it out there that, you know what, this organization, they had a lot of good results with changing the behavior of black people. And it's just not happening, and it's sad because the minister is still here.
Eric, this is Mr. Bernstein. And Eric, of course, makes a great point, because I think What Eric's comment goes to is the notion that no one single agency or entity is going to just stop the violence in our city. It's not going to just be the police department. It's not just going to be the mayor's office. It's not just going to be the state's attorney's office. We all have to work together to accomplish this goal, and it really begins with the community. And to the extent that we can work with the communities and they can be involved to try and get them engaged, I think goes a long way. And I think that's really, you know, the point that Eric's trying to drive at, and I'm willing to be a part of that. I try to be. You know, I'm out, gosh, almost every night at community meetings around the city, and I do it for a very specific reason. I do it so that the communities know my commitment to stopping the violence in our city, and so that they know that we are there to talk to them and to elicit their support. Because once we have their support, it makes our job easier in terms of building better cases.
I think that also goes to the question. I think you're right, and you have to extend that, I think, to public policy and what people and how we spend our money, and where we're going to invest it, and how much we invest in things like.
Well, but see, then, you know, Mark, you that comes back to the discussion about the marijuana, because – and the ACLU study does a good job of pointing this out. When you start – I think, Sonia, correct me if I'm wrong, but the number for Maryland in terms of costs from law enforcement, conviction, incarceration last year, or 2010 or 2011, was about $100
million. Yep, $106
million. For marijuana.
So you have to look at that number.
Yep.
I'm giving props to Sonia, but that's okay.
Thank you.
No, she deserves them.
But when you get – so you look at – but this is to your point, Mark. So you could really – you know, you could, from a public policy standpoint, you can really start talking about shifting the whole paradigm, because the paradigm can then become, you know, if we can take that money and use it in a way to be even better or more aggressive or more focused on prosecuting violent crime, then you start to see even better results.
Right. But I think it's really important to remember the solutions that exist outside of law enforcement and how critical I think that is to responding to these issues.
Well, we can fight over the money when we get it.
Right. I think then we need to have that discussion publicly and how we want to spend our money.
Right. And that $100 million doesn't even – that's just the law enforcement cost. And that's a middle estimate. That's not even the high
that's
estimate.
That's correct. Right.
And that doesn't at all get to the sort of the human cost or the cost of people losing their jobs or all of the other sort of resources that are lost.
Let's go back to the phones at 410-319-8888. Neil Franklin's on the line. Neil, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi,
hey,
Neil.
Mark.
Welcome, Neil.
Hey, great show, by the way.
Thank you.
Rick Bernstein, I just want to say that I read the article by Mr. Bernstein, and I do agree with decriminalization versus legalization. I think that it's important that if we do this, we move towards having the proper discussion for legalization. Two quick comments regarding Washington and Colorado. I have been out there. I have been monitoring the situation out in Washington State. I've met with the city state's attorney out there. I've met with the liquor control board for the state, and they are both elated to be moving in this direction. They see no real problems with moving forward with policy and readjusting that policy as they move forward, but they are making it happen. One of the most important things is that they are no longer arresting people for marijuana possession. Relationships between the police department and the community, mainly in King County, are improving. And, you know, the city attorney out there who is in the same position as Mr. Bernstein is just, he's ecstatic about this, and he just can't wait to see what lies ahead as things improve for the city of Seattle.
Well, Neil, what I will do is reach out to you so maybe we can have a conversation and get the state's attorney for Seattle and others to come on the show to talk about just how it's being dealt with there. We'd like to have a conversation with them. I think that would be good for our citizens in Maryland to hear.
Yeah, I think that would be a great idea. And just one other thing, the Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Bakes has an opportunity at the mayor's conference while she's out there to sign a resolution joining other mayors from around the country, which would allow, you know, which will remove the federal government. They're asking the federal government to step back and let communities decide what's going to work best for them as they move forward.
Thank you, sir. Good to have you here with us. Let's get another quick call in before the end of the hour. Tyrone, you're on the air. Tyrone, you're on the air. Want to turn down your phone, please? I mean, your radio.
Okay.
Welcome.
Am I on?
Yes, you're on, Tyrone.
Yeah, I'm afraid to even bring this up, you mean, because I sure don't want to be targeted.
Well, go ahead, man. We don't know who you are.
But sometimes I feel like this this drug thing and the arresting of all, I mean, the blacks in the communities is all a part of a big conspiracy to me, because I vaguely remember right before Commissioner Clark left that he went down Dundalk at the terminals down there and all those ships and made a real big drug bust. Now, and I heard it one night, that one night when they had this on the news, and I heard no more about it.
I don't remember that.
Not even on your talk shows have I heard anybody discussing about that. When was the last time that anybody from the department went down Dundalk on those ships and made any, found up any drugs down there anymore?
I have no idea. Is there a task force like that, Greg Bernstein, to go down and deal with that?
Well, the you've got the U.S. Customs Service, DEA. They certainly monitor the ports and develop intelligence, and to the extent that they can stop the flow of drugs in through our ports, they certainly try to do that. That would be what the feds are doing.
And most people probably who do the importing of large amounts of marijuana and other drugs don't do it through the ports.
You know,
I should imagine.
There's all kinds of points of entry.
Lots of points of entry. Greg Bernstein, thank you so much again for coming in and talking to the
citizens.
Always
a pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Look forward to doing this on a regular basis. It's good to have the dialogue with the community. Thank you for being here.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
And Sonia Kumar, thank you for all the work you've done at ACLU and the work you did to raise this marijuana issue. I think we're going to keep it rolling. I will work with Neil to get the folks from Seattle on to see how it's working out there. It'd be a good conversation for our citizens to have as well, to hear what they have to say.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for your time. Thanks for dashing in this morning and being here so early.
Of course.
We appreciate you coming in.
Thanks.
We're going to take a very brief break and we turn to sound bites. We look at the Farm Bill. We look at obesity in our society. We talk about some other issues and hear an incredible gluten-free recipe at the end of the hour. Stay with us. We'll be right back.